Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument this morning is Pine Top Receivables against Banco de Seguros.
Good morning. May it please the court, I am Mary Cannon Veed, and I do represent Pine Top Receivables of Philadelphia. This is a case that I have to say I thought I'd never see, with two interlocutory appeals in one case in 35 years of law practice. I haven't had one of them. And they're two very different ones.
I have a jurisdictional question about one of them.
Do you have one?
Yes, indeed.
All right.
I'm uncertain about the source of our jurisdiction over the arbitration appeal. The parties appear to assume that jurisdiction is supplied by 9 U.S.C. 16, which is in Chapter 1 of the Federal Arbitration Act. But Chapter 1 applies only to domestic arbitrations. It's Chapter 3 that applies to foreign arbitrations, and Chapter 3 does not have any corresponding provision to Section 16. So I wonder how Section 16 can be used to support an interlocutory appeal in a case involving international arbitration.
I don't think I've ever heard that question before.
You've now heard it.
Your Honor, it was not addressed by anyone.
Jurisdiction is something we are obliged to raise on our own, whether the parties raise it or not.
You're absolutely correct about that. But I am not particularly well prepared to respond to it because it was not raised previously. It appears from what I have seen in other internationally based arbitrations, including quite a number of them involving this particular defendant, that the denial of a motion to compel arbitration is in fact immediately appealable. But I agree with you that the convention does control this, and that this is a convention arbitration, and the jurisdictional prerequisites to it are perhaps different. If I remember correctly, and I'm going off the top of my head here, the convention does provide that international convention arbitrations are to be conducted and offered the same degree of respect and procedural efficacy as local ones. And I can't believe that would mean that a denial of a motion to compel arbitration would not get the same degree of judicial intervention or appellate intervention as
that's one not the question. The question
I know.
Is when.
I know. That's the best I can do at the moment, Your Honor. I'd be very happy to brief that separately.
In the end, I may ask both sides to file supplemental briefs on this question.
I think that would be a good idea because literally I'm talking through my hat on this.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's proceed.
Okay. So, just because we have too many things named Pine Top in this case, Pine Top Receivables of Illinois, as well as the Pine Top Insurance Company and the liquidator of Pine Top, just as a convention, I'm going to refer to my client as the plaintiff. And if I say the word Pine Top, it means I'm referring to Pine Top Insurance Company or perhaps to the liquidator of Pine Top Insurance Company. Pine Top entered into liquidation or entered into receivership proceedings in 1986. Almost 25 years later, the liquidator was finally about to the bottom of the barrel in marshaling its assets. And there were a few that stood between him and the ability to close the estate and send the final pieces of money out to the policyholders. And they were difficult to collect assets for one reason or another. Some of them were just downright hopeless. And in order to push the estate over that last hurdle, he issued a request for proposals that attracted, a half dozen separate bidders for the rights to take over from the liquidation estate the remaining reinsurance receivables of Pine Top. My client was a successful bidder. The request for proposals included as part of the package a form of assignment agreement. And invited the successful bidder to submit markups to it if they wanted to change it. But the form of that agreement was initially set out in the bidding package. Now, the court below did not pay any attention to that fact because it considered itself bound by the parole evidence rule. And yet this court has already noticed, and certainly Illinois courts have said many times, that the parole evidence rule does not apply when you have a dispute between the party to the contract and a third party. The parole evidence rule applies to disputes between the two parties to the contract in question. The parties to the contract, as long as they agree, can fool around with the contract to their heart's content. They can rearrange the terms. They can ignore them. They can have course of dealing and custom and practice or whatever they want. As long as they're happy, no outsider can tell them they're doing anything wrong. So it was inappropriate for the district court to refuse to consider not just information about how this particular contract got entered into and who wrote it and so forth, but also to ignore and refuse to consider the affidavit of the counsel for the liquidator who submitted voluntarily an affidavit on the motion for reconsideration that explicitly affirmed the plaintiff's position on the scope of their intended conveyance of arbitration. Now, I would say there are two kinds of discrimination that took place by the district court in this case, and both of them are incorrect. The first one is that the district court treated the assignee of a chosen action, seemed to have assumed that the assignee of a chosen action would receive fewer rights, that the quality of the item that was assigned to it would be diminished because it had been assigned. That's improbable. Certainly the liquidator, Pinetop, had no more use for these assets. In fact, just about a month after the ink was dry on this assignment agreement, the liquidator submitted an application to the court supervising him and arranged for the disposition of almost every single dollar he had left to the policyholders and shut the estate down. He had no reason to need to retain any rights under these contracts. So somehow in the space between the liquidator and the assignee, a valuable right disappeared. And that's not a result that the court should be stretching to achieve. The second form of discrimination that occurred here, and also was wrong, is that we're talking here about a right to arbitrate. And under the Federal Arbitration Act, and under the convention as well, right to arbitrate shall be, terms in a contract requiring arbitration, shall be enforced to the same extent as other terms in the contract. The court should not apply special scrutiny to a right to arbitrate. And yet that's what the court did here. The court assumed that this contract was effective to transfer some of the rights relating to the reinsurance treaties to the plaintiff, but for some reason got hung up on the exact wording of the portions of the contract that he considered might have applied to the right to arbitrate. And that, by applying that kind of intensive scrutiny, I believe the court did a great deal of damage. The fact of the matter is this agreement really couldn't have been much clearer. And it got even more clear when the plaintiffs were permitted to add one of their few additions to the form contract that they were handed as successful bidder. The contract, as drafted by the liquidator, conveyed all rights in the debts, absolutely and with full title. Now, the court wondered why the contract transferred only the debts. The answer to that is very simple. These are reinsurance contracts. They're personal contracts. Most of the rights arising from a reinsurance contract can't be assigned. A reinsurance contract permits the ceding company to bind the reinsurer to accept insurance risk sight unseen. A reinsurance contract permits the ceding company to decide to settle a claim and make the reinsurer pay it, and the reinsurer can't do a thing about it. He is absolutely required to trust the ceding company. We use the term follow the fortunes in a lot of different settings, somewhat loosely, but this is a good example of exactly what they mean. The reinsurer has to count on the character and integrity of the company it's agreed to do business, and it just won't do to trade that company out for somebody else. Now, as it turned out here, the reinsurance company may have made a bad bet. They might have done better with my client than they did with Pine Top because affairs didn't turn out that well. But that was their decision. They made that choice, and they were entitled to be protected by it. But once even a personal contract has produced debts, shows as an action, money owed, it's no longer those rights are no longer personal, and they can be assigned just like everybody else. There's a case that I just love the name of called Ginsburg versus Bulldog Auto Fire Insurance Association from 1922 that holds that. On both sides of that equation, first, that personal contracts like insurance policies can't be assigned, and secondly, that rights to be paid money under an insurance contract can be assigned. The assignment agreement also included a statement that the plaintiffs were authorized to demand, sue for, compromise, and recover all amounts due under the debts. Again, then that's the place where the court really focused its attention and dissected that wording very carefully and seems to have made up its mind that the only rights conveyed by this contract were the rights to demand, sue for, compromise, and recover. And he read the word sue for to mean file a lawsuit about only, and no other way of demanding or requesting or receiving the benefits that were conveyed. But in doing that, the court essentially ignored the next sentence in the paragraph, which says that the liquidator was assigning to the plaintiffs full authority to do all things necessary or useful to enforce the debts and assignor's rights thereunder pursuant to this assignment agreement. The court did something funny, and I honestly think it might have been just a mistake, and that is this. In explaining why he did not believe that clause changed anything, he said, in effect, that all that conveyed was the right to enforce the assignee's rights under the assignment agreement. I think he got the or in the e backwards. I really do. Because otherwise, if what he's saying is that this big, broad, all things necessary and useful clause added absolutely nothing to the sentence before it, what he's done is absolutely written that clause out of the agreement. And it's Hornbook law. Every clause in an agreement is presumed to be put there for a reason. And if you say things in two different ways, it's presumably because you mean two different things. So I believe that was an error on the court's part. And in particular, to apply that kind of hard-nosed, nitpicky reading to the right to arbitrate when the same kind of minutia was not applied to the other rights conveyed under the contract, I believe violates the spirit and the intent of the Arbitration Act in the Panama Convention. I'll make one last point about this. My clients are factors. They buy and sell distressed debt. People like to call them vultures. Sometimes when they're kind, they call them scavengers. The defendants here in their briefing have commented extensively on speculations about the plaintiff's motives, integrity, willingness to try to convince their reasons for demanding arbitration. They accuse us of hoping to convince the arbitrators to ignore Banco's legitimate defenses, which you haven't even heard about yet, and to enforce the contracts in spite of what they say. Those assertions have no place.
Excuse me. Why is there a dispute about arbitration? If everything is as clear as you say, you should just be asking the district court to enter summary judgment in your favor and avoid the arbitration. And I'm puzzled by the party's position. Usually it's reinsurers who are demanding arbitration and people in your position who are trying to avoid it.
Certainly not in this case, Your Honor. Our right to arbitrate, we believe, is clear.
Right. If, as you say, the contract is clear, you're in court, the defendant is happy to be in court, if you're right, you can prevail in this case next week, And yet you seem determined not to do that. And that's what's puzzling to me.
Well, again, you're speculating on motive, too, I'd gently suggest. But our right to arbitrate is clear. I will say that after 25 years
of
being...
You're not addressing my question.
May I please?
My question is, if, as you say, you're obviously entitled under the contract to win on the merits, why don't you just ask the district court to rule in your favor on the merits, and you'll be done?
Because it is not that obvious that we're entitled to win on the merits. Okay. The 25 years of reinsurance accounting and reinsurance administration by Pinetop and the liquidator have laid thick layers of muddle and confusion on this package of debts. The defendants rightfully complain that we can't even find our copy of one of the reinsurance treaties in question. Fortunately, we did find it in the defendant's submissions, but there's a lot going on here. And our very strong opinion, honestly, is that arbitration is preferable for two reasons. One of them is that because it's very, very important to my client to receive some assurance that if they fight this fight and sort out this mess, and it is something of a mess, that there's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow and that they can get paid. So traditionally, arbitrators will award pre-judgment security. Again, will require the posting of pre-judgment security, and they're more likely to do that. This is outside the Foreign Sovereign Immunities and the Unauthorized Insurers Act context. So arbitration is nice from that point of view. But more important, somebody's going to have to really understand the ins and outs of the customs and practices and behaviors and accounting and terminology of the reinsurance industry. And I'm sure that Judge Yasmin can do that, but I'm pretty sure that a panel of three distinguished arbitrators can do it better. And that's our position, and that's why we go there. It's absolutely not true that our rights under this – I hate to admit it. I'm sure I'll hear about it again. But it's absolutely not true that our rights under these contracts are really cut and dried. There are – questions of timing, there are questions of disclosure, there are questions of accounting, and I think my client's technician has come up with a spreadsheet with something like 350 entries of documents that he considers crucial to be able to trace where these balances came from and how they got that way. That's not so easy. So there's a lot to do.
And you say that it's real clear that arbitration is required, but when you look at that clause, you quoted 5.1, it's pretty broad language, and I agree with you, to the same extent and under the same conditions as the assignor could have done. But the parties didn't use that same language in 5.2 because they were very specific in terms of, as you pointed out, the demand, sue, compromise, and that kind of thing. So isn't that a problem? That's the issue I have.
That's certainly where Judge Aspin got stuck. But if you understand the sequence of how this got drafted, that's also what caused my client to say, hey, wait a minute, that's one place we want to stick in a sentence. And that's where they came up with the all things necessary and useful language, which the liquidator gladly adopted. I think you can speculate about why the parties might have used slightly different language, but if you look at all things necessary and useful as meaning exactly what it says, I don't see where else you can go but to say it's useful, and I'll just explain why, to be able to arbitrate. And that ought to be the end of the story. And speculating about why they might have said the other one differently, it's different drafting hands is what it is. I don't believe that you should attribute any significance at all, at least in the sense of so much significance that you override the clear terms of the underlying contracts which compel arbitration. And in fact, you know, you have to remember that the liquidator could not make the arbitration clauses in these treaties go away by assigning the treaties to a third party. The assignee of a contract containing an arbitration clause is required to arbitrate under ordinary circumstances. And the Williston states it very plainly. By the same token, he can demand arbitration. You can't make an arbitration obligation or right go away by assigning it to a stranger. It's unlike the reinsurance, is not a personal Right. It is something that is closely tied to the contract, and you can't move the contract without also moving the arbitration clause. So there's almost nothing that the parties could have put in the assignment agreement that could have changed that. And they didn't intend, there's no indication that they intended to. There is no explanation of any kind of a motive why they would possibly have wanted to do that, how it would have served their mutual purposes. And Mr. Guberman's affidavit says plain as day, anything that was going to make these assets more valuable, we wanted to give them because we sure didn't need them anymore. And we wanted to get the most possible money for our policyholders. And the way we were going to do that was not by being chintzy with the way we signed the contracts. And Judge Asplund assumes that for some reason the liquidator was being parsimonious. And there's absolutely no reason to believe that that's the case. I see I spent more time than I intended on that subject because I think it's equally important that we also talk about the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. The Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act was adapted because of a dysfunction in the way that the foreign sovereigns engaging in commercial activity were being treated in this country. It produced an outpouring of collective work by law professors and the State Department and the American Bar Association and Congress as well to produce a draft of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, which was extremely detailed, technical, and specific. It included a statement that prejudgment, attachment, arrest, and execution that the sovereign, even when engaged in commercial activities, prejudgment, attachment, arrest, and execution are prohibited. And the question is, what the heck is an attachment, arrest, and execution? If you look at the legislative history of the FSIA, you will see that most of the act was adopted by Congress wholesale after it got the recommendations from all the law professors in the Department of State.
I don't understand the significance of the history you're pointing to. Supreme Court says you can use legislative history to disambiguate an ambiguous term. So is any of the legislative history that you're relying on an attempt to disambiguate the word attachment?
Your Honor, what I am relying on it is to say that the word attachment means exactly what it says. Second Circuit in the case
that the word is self-defining, then we can't go to the legislative history at all. That's the Supreme Court's view. You cannot consult the legislative history to contradict clear language. You can look at legislative history to disambiguate an ambiguous term. So if you think attachment is ambiguous, we can go to legislative history that discusses the meaning of the word attachment. But I didn't see anything in your brief discussing the meaning of the word attachment.
That's because I believe I'm simply using the legislative history because the Second Circuit, in the case that was relied on by the district court, did make some assumptions about what Congress intended when it used that language. And the court talked about the eviscerating the protections for...
Come on back to my question. Is any of the legislative history that you're discussing an attempt to explicate the meaning of the word attachment?
No, I don't believe it is.
Okay. Then under the Supreme Court's view, we can't consider it. Has any court of appeals disagreed with the Second Circuit's holding in Stevens?
This court has pointed out that it has not adopted that holding.
This court has said the issue is open.
The issue is open.
Would you address my question, please? Has any court of appeals disagreed with the Second Circuit's decision in Stevens?
No, sir.
Thank you.
I believe that my request, this is, as far as I know, the only court of appeals other than the Second Circuit in which the question has been presented. And so, as I said, the question is open. The Second Circuit assumed wrongly that the purpose and intent of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act was actually to protect the interests of foreign sovereigns. It was not. It decided that the word attachment, which has a clear legal meaning, it has a space in the rules of civil procedure and in the rules of civil procedure in the state of Illinois. But the court said attachment meant not only those things, but also any other mechanism that has the same effect of tying up the sovereign's money. And There is no support in the word attachment or in the legal interpretations of the word attachment for that point. And you're completely correct, Your Honor, that as long as we don't feel that there's something ambiguous here that needs explication, we shouldn't be looking at the legislative history at all. The other thing that the Second Circuit did that this Court definitely has disagreed with is it rejected a contention that the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, if it was read the way that the circuit was going, would in fact conflict with the regulation of insurance, a statute, the Uniform or the Unauthorized Insurance Practice Act, that was in effect for state insurance regulation.
Thank you, Ms. Reed.
Thank you.
Mr. Pallone.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Ernesto. May it please the Court. My name is Ernesto Palomo, and I represent Banco de Seguros del Estado. I'd like to start, Your Honor, first with your question about jurisdiction. I believe that Section 3 has a provision that incorporates Section 1 and all the provisions of Section 1, but only to the extent that they don't conflict with Section 3.
I'm lost. I don't understand what you mean by Section 3. You mean Chapter 3?
Chapter 3 of the...
Section 302, which is part of Chapter 3, expressly incorporates six designated parts of Chapter 1. It basically incorporates Sections 2 through 7. It does not incorporate Section 16. Is there any incorporation provision in Chapter 3 other than Section 302 that I might be missing?
I didn't have that language in front of me, Your Honor, so I might have misspoken.
That's part of the problem. There is an express incorporation in Chapter 3, but it doesn't include Section 16. That's what got me to ask these questions.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, the district court correctly held the plaintiff's request for prejudgment security is barred under the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. To begin with, prejudgment security under Section 123 of the Illinois Insurance Code is a prejudgment attachment within the meaning of Section 1610B of the FSIA. That was the holding in Stevens and all of the other cases that we cited in our brief. Notably, Stevens is nearly 20 years old. It's never been questioned. It's never been overruled. And every court that has looked at the same issue has decided the case exactly the same way as Stevens. The Stevens case was correctly decided.
You say every court that's looked at the same issue. Has any other court of appeals agreed with Stevens? I mean, Ms. Veed said no court of appeals has disagreed with Stevens. Has any court of appeals agreed with Stevens?
Not at the court of appeals level, but district courts and in state courts, they've agreed with Stevens. So because the case law does not support its position, the plaintiff has to argue legislative history. It argues, again, as we've heard, that the term attachment means the formal attachment under federal and state rules of civil procedure. But the legislative history does not support this argument. The House report, which we cite in our brief, does explain what Section 1610D means. It says that it concerns any attachment for the purpose of securing a judgment. That provision, Section 1610D, is intended to provide, quote, a provisional remedy, for example, to prevent assets from being dissipated or removed from the jurisdiction in order to frustrate satisfaction of a judgment, end quote. Several state courts and other courts have addressed this particular language of the legislative history, and each one of them concluded that the term attachment has a much broader meaning than in the traditional civil procedure sense. We cited those cases in our brief, and we have yet to hear a response from the plaintiff on those issues. A prejudgment attachment is commonly defined as the seizure of a person's property for the purpose of securing a future judgment. That is the definition in Black's Law Dictionary. That's the definition in Amger. That is the definition in the Second Circuit cases involving the government of Argentina that the plaintiff cites. Banco submits that this definition, the seizure of a person's property in order to secure a judgment, is the definition that Congress had in mind when it used the term attachment in Section 1610D, which is the provision at issue here. The plaintiff has admitted that Section 123 of the Illinois Insurance Code is a measure that seizes the person's property prior to judgment. That should end the analysis. The prejudgment security requirement at issue here is a prejudgment attachment under the FSIA. In its reply brief, the plaintiff tries to suggest that the Second Circuit has retreated from the holding in Stevens, but that's simply not correct. In NML Capital versus Argentina, the court upheld an injunction that required Argentina to honor an equal treatment provision. And that provision simply said that Argentina had to pay its creditors equally and without any preference. The court in NML Capital cited SNS machinery, and it also cited Stevens with approval, but it distinguished those cases. The injunction at issue in NML Capital did not involve the seizure of assets in order to secure a future judgment. So that's why that ruling has no application here. The Stevens case is alive and well everywhere except in the plaintiff's mind. Banco did not waive its immunity from prejudgment attachment. The standard is that the waiver must be unequivocal because prejudgment security is a harsh remedy that can be used by opportunistic parties for nefarious purposes. In its initial brief, the plaintiff raised three arguments for why Banco waived its immunity from prejudgment attachment. None of those reasons were addressed here, and I believe they abandoned them. But in any event, I'll go through them anyway. The mere fact that Banco agreed to arbitrate disputes with Pinetop does not in any way, cannot in any way be viewed as an explicit waiver of immunity. The arbitration clause do not mention prejudgment security or any other remedy. Further, there is nothing in the so-called reserves clause that can be viewed as an explicit waiver of immunity. We quoted the language of the reserves clause in our briefs. We explained what it means, and even today, the plaintiff still hasn't addressed, you know, how that reserves clause can possibly be viewed as a waiver of immunity from prejudgment attachment. We've also raised a couple of other arguments in our brief regarding why prejudgment security should not be awarded. They're all equally meritorious. I'm not going to argue them all here, but I do want to address briefly the McCarran-Ferguson argument that the plaintiff has advanced. First of all, the court should reject this newfound McCarran-Ferguson argument. As the plaintiff readily admitted in its brief, the plaintiff never asked the district court to find that the McCarran-Ferguson Act supplants the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act.
And it's pretty clear that the district court didn't think it was raised as well, is that right? Didn't discuss it.
That's right. They never raised it in the district court, so they never had a chance to opine on that issue. And I believe that the issue should be raised there in the first instance. But in any event, the McCarran-Ferguson Act argument fails on the merits. It is indisputable that the Constitution gives Congress the exclusive power to regulate foreign commerce. This cannot be debated, and the plaintiff has never intimated otherwise. Congress exercised that exclusive power when it enacted the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. The Supreme Court has held that the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act must be applied in every action involving a foreign sovereign.
But given the plain language of McCarran-Ferguson, wasn't it incumbent upon Congress in the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act to explicitly address the issue of insurance?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because first of all, McCarran-Ferguson applies only to domestic commerce legislation.
What authority do you have for that?
Senator Ferguson said that himself on the floor of the debate.
What is the Supreme Court? I'm sorry.
What bit of ambiguous language in the McCarran-Ferguson Act does that address?
Well, I'm not sure how to answer that. Right. There's no
naked legislative history. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt Judge Grill.
Well, has the Supreme Court ever talked about that as to whether or not McCarran-Ferguson was clearly intended to be limited to domestic rather than?
I'm not sure I can say that they ever held that it applies only to domestic commerce litigation, cases in our brief where they intimated that that was the purpose.
What do you think would be the best case for that?
I'm sorry. I can write a letter to you and point that out if the court wants. But they did say that in at least three or four different cases.
Hmm.
But in any event,
I'm puzzled. I ask Ms. Veed one question about her client's litigating strategy. I have a puzzle about yours. Why don't you embrace the argument that the McCarran-Ferguson Act means the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act is irrelevant? Because without the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, your client probably can't be hailed into American court at all. Right? What's going on in this case is that Pine Top Receivables wants to knock out Section 1609 of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. But the argument that's been offered knocks out the entire Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, and I would think eliminates the basis for suing a foreign sovereign. It just drops us back into the world as it was before the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. And as Ms. Veed says, I think it's at page 22, 23 of Pinetop's reply brief, the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act is essential for suing the commercial operations of foreign sovereigns. Without it, you can't sue the commercial operations of foreign sovereigns. So here you are. You would be benefited by getting rid of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, resolutely defending the application of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. I find this a puzzle.
Your Honor, we never considered that argument. It never occurred to us that was even a possibility.
Surely the one thing that is not possible is knocking out 28 U.S.C. 1609 and leaving the rest of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act applicable. It either applies en bloc to the insurance business or it doesn't.
I agree with that, Your Honor. And I'm also going to just go back to what I said before, is that in Argentine Republic versus Amerada Hess, Supreme Court clearly stated that every action involving a foreign sovereign must involve the use of the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. I don't see how I can get around that by saying McCarran-Ferguson trumps the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act.
I'm missing the significance of that. If McCarran-Ferguson means the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act does not apply to the insurance business, then the result, as stated by the Supreme Court in Amerada Hess, is that foreign sovereign insurers cannot be sued in U.S. court, period. Pine Top would have to go and bring this suit in Uruguay.
Well, if the court is willing to adopt that position, we'll certainly take it.
We're not. But you're resisting that position. You've told us that the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act does apply. That's why I'm so puzzled.
I don't have anything else to say about that issue other than we never considered that argument before. We've also raised arguments regarding retroactive laws. I'll just rest on the briefs on that particular issue unless the court has any particular questions. Okay. We now move to the issue that is likely dispositive of the entire case. As this court already noted, the plaintiff apparently has figured out that this case will not survive a motion for summary judgment in the federal district court. The claims that they have bought from the liquidator of the Pine Top Estate are nearly 20 years old. They will not survive summary judgment. That is why the plaintiff is fighting tooth and nail to move this dispute to arbitration. Indeed, Ms. Feet admitted just now that she is doing forum shopping to avoid the dismissal. But the problem for the plaintiff is that the plaintiff is not a party to any contract that contains an arbitration clause. They never purchased the right to demand arbitration from Banco or any other insurer. Plaintiff appears to argue that the district court should not have interpreted the assignment agreement.
Well, according, Mr. Palomo, could Banco have demanded arbitration? Could Banco have demanded that this suit be sent to arbitration?
In our view, yes, Banco could have because...
But since arbitration is a creature of contract, as you emphasize, if Banco could demand arbitration, that must be because the arbitration is based on a contract. And if Banco could demand it, one would think the other side could demand it. I don't know any way in which Banco would be entitled to arbitration and the opposing party not entitled to arbitration. Is there any way in which that could happen?
In our view, there is. First of all, the arbitration clauses are very explicit. The duty to arbitrate runs only between Pine Top and Banco. It doesn't say anything about the liquidator or any subsequent.
Yes, I understand that possibility, but then you should answer my question by saying that Banco cannot demand arbitration against Pinetop Receivables because there is no privity of contract between Banco and Pinetop Receivables, and Pinetop did not assign the whole contract to plaintiff. That would be a consistent position. But the actual position, which is that Banco can demand arbitration, but plaintiff can't, is the one I have trouble understanding.
Let me explain that a little further for you, Your Honor. First of all, several jurisdictions, but not Illinois, they've adopted theories, or the estoppel theory, for instance, that might apply in a situation like this.
What law has to do with this? This is arbitration under Chapter 3 of the Federal Arbitration Act. This is federal law.
I've missed the first beginning of your statement, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
I don't see what Illinois law has to do with this. Arbitration would be under federal law, not state law. This is an international business transaction. It is governed by Chapter 3 of the Federal Arbitration Act, not by state law.
Okay, well, as the plaintiff has mentioned in their briefs, the Seventh Circuit, presumably applying federal law, has adopted an equitable estoppel remedy, and that applies when the assignee files an action under a contract that contains an arbitration clause, but at the same time denies the duty to arbitrate. In that situation, courts hold that it's inequitable to allow a plaintiff to do that. You can't sue under a contract but try to carve out one particular provision. That's not what happened here. So in that situation, I contend that Banco would be able to, if they wanted to, demand arbitration against the plaintiff because based on this estoppel theory that it seems to be rampant in the federal courts. But plaintiff seems to be arguing under contract theory that the district court was required to give the plaintiff the benefit of the doubt on their interpretation of the assignment agreement. But that is not the law. When a document...
I'm really not interested in benefits of doubts and other tiebreakers. What's bugging me, as I hope you can see, is the mutuality point. Since arbitration rests on a contract, if Banco says we would be entitled to demand arbitration, then the other side must be equally able to demand arbitration, because otherwise I don't understand how Banco's demand could be based on a contract.
The only theory that under which Banco could do that would be under the estoppel theory that previously addressed. But you're absolutely right. According to the arbitration clauses, the duty to arbitrate runs only between Pinetop and Banco. And now, the district court's analysis of the assignment agreement was absolutely correct. It goes without saying that the terms of an assignment determine the rights that the assignee takes, and it also determines the rights that the assignee does not take. Starting first with the bundle of rights that were excluded from the assignment. Section 2.4.1 states, the assignment contained in Clause 2.1 shall not be construed to be a novation or assignment of the policies. Thus, the plaintiff does not have any rights under the Pinetop Banco treaties. Second, Section 5.2 states, nothing in this agreement shall create any obligation on the part of the assignee to any person other than the assignor. This is a fundamental point because the duty to arbitrate is an obligation, and as the district court correctly noted, it appears that the plaintiff purposefully avoided the obligation to arbitrate. Now apparently the plaintiff has had a change of heart and they want to arbitrate because they know that their claims won't survive if it stays here, but that's not Banco's problem. The plaintiff acquired the debts. That's the only thing that they acquired. And that is defined as the money due and owing to Pinetop under the reinsurance treaties. But the plaintiff did not acquire all of Pinetop's rights under the debts. Section 2.1 specifically states, assignee shall accept such assignment on the terms and conditions contained in this assignment. So that means that we actually have to look at the terms and conditions of the assignment, which is what Judge Aspin did and what Judge Williams is suggesting that we do here. And Section 5.2, which is entitled The Authority of the Assignee, the agreement provides how the plaintiff can go about to collect the debts. It can demand, sue for, compromise, and recover the debts. None of these four rights have anything to do with arbitration. The plaintiff now argues that the power to do all things necessary or useful to enforce the debts includes the power to collect the debts. But if the court accepts that argument, then the court would be ignoring the immediately preceding sentence that says the plaintiff can take four specific actions to enforce the debts. There is no reason to list four specific actions if the intent was to transfer all rights. Further, it is clear that when the parties intended to transfer specific contract rights under the reinsurance treaties, parties knew how to express that intent in the language of the assignment agreement. Section 5.1, in that provision, the liquidator authorized the plaintiff to seek information, quote, to the same extent and under the same conditions as Pinetop could have done so in an exercise of his contractual rights. The parties could have used that same language in Section 5.2, but they did not. In the reinsurance world, money owed by one party to another often travels through brokers. Bonko submits that the language that the plaintiff is hanging its head on, the power to do all things necessary and useful to enforce the debts, that provision merely transferred the power to enforce whatever rights Pinetop had vis-a-vis the brokers. And Bonko is not merely speculating or pulling this information out of thin air. Plaintiff's counsel drafted that language, and she said in an email that we've introduced into the record that the purpose and the intent of that language was to make clear that the plaintiff had the right to go after documents and money in the hands of brokers. Bonko's interpretation harmonizes all of the contract provisions in the assignment agreement, which, of course, is one of the main goals and objects of contract interpretation. This court should hold that Pinetop's arbitration rights were not part of the bundle of rights that were transferred. At this time, I'd like to point out, I agree with one of plaintiff's statements, specifically regarding the Ginsburg versus Bulldog Auto case. And that Illinois Supreme Court case said that when you sign a fully executed insurance contract, when there is nothing left to do except pay the amount owed, what you are actually acquiring is called a chosen action. And Illinois has enacted a statute that deals exactly with this situation. It says that the assignee of a chosen action must enforce his or her claim in court. Plaintiff also argues that it is required to arbitrate. It has really no choice in the matter. But that's a different that argument has never been made before. In a very similar situation, the same individuals who own the plaintiff and the same counsel that's sitting here to my left made a very different argument. They resisted a motion to compel arbitration in a very similar situation. Again, the only reason why they are asking for arbitration now is because they want to avoid dismissal of their time-barred claims. And I'd like to address briefly the parole evidence argument. The assignment agreement is clear and unambiguous. Thus, it can be construed as a matter of law without resort to any extrinsic evidence. That was this court's ruling in the MPRO manufacturing case, which we cited in our brief. In that case, the court held when a contract is clear, contractual intent is determined by the terms of the contract alone. The plaintiff attempts to argue that it is entitled to offer extrinsic evidence just because Bonko is not a party to the assignment agreement. We disagree with that, and we think that the fully integrated assignment agreement can be construed as a matter of law. But in any event, to the extent the court does consider extrinsic evidence, it should only consider objective evidence, not self-serving and conclusory intent affidavits like the ones that were submitted here. What the plaintiff submitted here is inherently unreliable and easily fabricated. This court should reject the plaintiff's efforts to rewrite the assignment agreement through the use of unsupported intent affidavits. And lastly, unless there's any questions on the assignment agreement, I'll move to the estoppel argument. under general Illinois contract law, for estoppel to apply, you need two elements. You need a statement or a conduct by one party, which induces the other party to act to its detriment. These elements are not present here. There is no allegation that Bonko induced the plaintiff to do anything. Thus, there is no estoppel under general Illinois law. The plaintiff believes that Bonko should be estopped merely because it asserted affirmative defenses, but there is no case that holds that merely by asserting affirmative defenses to a breach of contract claim, you are estopped from denying arbitration. In sum, the district court reached the correct conclusion on every ruling at issue here. Bonko submits that the district court should be affirmed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Palomo. Now, the case is taken under advisement. I'd like the parties to file supplemental briefs addressing whether we have appellate jurisdiction of the arbitration appeal under 9 U.S.C. Section 16. Those briefs should be filed simultaneously and within 14 days. And when they're received, we'll take the case under advisement. Thank you very much.